This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild. Welcome to Progressive Radio. Today we're going to be talking about the presidential race, and with me to discuss this is the Progressive's political editor, Ruth Conniff, fresh back from the Democratic Convention. Hey, Ruth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What was the convention like?
It was interesting. It was, this is my fifth convention, and I've noticed after the Seattle protests against the World Trade Organization, this enormous ratcheting up of the police in riot gear and the big barricades and the quote-unquote free speech areas where protesters are allowed to protest behind chain link fences at some great distance from the actual convention site. So Boston was a new high. Of course, in the wake of September 11th, everyone was worried about terrorism. And the atmosphere, the first thing that struck me in Boston was the atmosphere of an armed camp. And I am sure that it will be even more intense in New York. There was just this feeling of a changed country, that we live in a country now where every corner had police. Instead of traffic signals, there were police controlling the traffic. There were police with huge automatic weapons everywhere you looked. There were helicopters hovering overhead. There were giant cement barricades. And, of course, the infamous free speech area, which was just outrageous, Orwellian in its name. And really, you know, the protesters compared it to a concentration camp. It kind of looked like a crazy dog pound to me.
And were people penned in there, Ruth Conniff, or was it not a place where the protesters gathered? Did they go outside the pen, or were they really forced into that pen?
They tried to force them in. There were the most vocal protester that I met in the free speech area was Randall Terry, the founder of Operation Rescue, and he had a bunch of anti-abortion protesters around him. But he was mocking the free speech area, and there was plenty of material for him to work with. He was pointing to the snipers overhead and the razor wire surrounding him and just saying, "This is free speech, is this what the Democratic Party stands for?" And I thought it was embarrassing for the Democrats. Another group of protesters.
It may have been the police and the Secret Service's choice, too.
Well, the DNC had a lot to do with the design and the layout. I mean, they have to take responsibility for that. You know, the local police were just doing what they could do. But I think the Democrats do have to take some responsibility. There were some protesters who escaped the pen. Medea Benjamin of WTO Protest fame and her organization Code Pink, which is opposing the war in Iraq, got out, put a sign up on the giant wall surrounding the convention center. They were still a good 800 meters from the actual site of the convention, but the police tried to force them back and make them take their sign off the outside of this wall. They had a scuffle with police. They finally put up their sign, which said, "U.S. troops, come home now." And they gave their speeches to a couple of TV cameras, and they basically, all of these protesters said that they were supporting John Kerry. So I thought that the control that they were trying to impose on these protesters and the message of the protesters were in stark contrast.
It's amazing that you mentioned the DNC and its control at the convention. I talked with Medea Benjamin. She told me she was thrown out of the convention during Teresa Hines' speech because at that point she hoisted that same banner, maybe, or a smaller one, U.S. out of Iraq or something, and the DNC kicked her out. And then the next day she went in to the Latino caucus and started to unfurl a banner or something, and they took her out. She came back in, and then a member of NOW told the DNC folks, "Don't lay a hand on that woman." So I guess she was able to prevail finally. And then there was a delegate I talked to, an actual Kerry delegate who had been at the Democratic Convention, Bobby Kennedy delegate in 1968. This was the second Democratic Convention he went to. And all he wanted to do was bring in a no war sign, and they wouldn't let him do that. And he complained about it and couldn't believe they weren't allowing free speech there at the Democratic Convention whatsoever.
Some gay and lesbian groups had signs that were quickly obscured. They had a sign czar at the convention site who would rush signs onto the floor, Kerry Edwards signs, to surround anybody who had anything that looked like a divisive or controversial sign. This show of unity was going to happen come hell or high water. And even though most people were not in much mood to show anything but unity, where you did see any sign to protest or dissent, it was quickly obscured by the delegates surrounding that person and blocking out their sign with a happier sign.
What do you make of the speeches there? What was your favorite speech?
Well, Obama. I think Obama, if not Sharpton. Actually, I'm going to take that back. Sharpton was my favorite speech. He got the delegates so riled up. And that was the only sign of breaking ranks. Even though he gave a completely pro-Kerry, completely pro-Democrat message, he took on Bush directly. He went off script. He took more time than he was supposed to. But what I think the television coverage and the news coverage that I've heard about afterwards missed was that people were insanely excited for this thing. I mean, they were so ready for some red meat. And when he spoke directly to the president and talked about the Republicans' hypocrisy on race and Bush daring to try to court the black vote and say that they were the party of Abe Lincoln, and he had his whole kind of rhythmic and kind of wonderful response to that, it was great. It was sort of the only spontaneous moment in the convention that was so tightly scripted.
Yeah, they never got their 40 acres and a mule, so he got off the mule and got on a donkey.
Yeah.
Everyone laughed at that one.
It was great.
My criticism from my couch of the convention was that the Democrats weren't tough enough. I know they made this intentional effort to be polite and be good little Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, but I thought, you know, if you're trying to convince a non-voter or a Nader voter, or for that matter, an independent or moderate Republican, seems to me that they should have scared people more, that they should have talked about Cheney and Ashcroft wanting to send the police into people's homes when they're not there and putting recording devices on their computers and leaving and not telling them about it, just really specific stuff that people could get frightened enough about to rally behind the Democrats. Obviously, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Democrats are going to go for Kerry anyway. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, this is the great debate, and those of us on the left who notice that the number of people who actually cast a vote is shrinking every election have always said to the Democratic Party, you know, why don't you take a look at your base? Why don't you take a look at the many, many African-American voters who don't even bother to go to the polls, all the people that could be motivated to actually come out and vote and who would be likely, certainly not Republican voters and therefore likely Democratic voters if there's not a big third-party alternative. And, you know, that's our position, and the position of the pollsters who inform these guys is that they have to go after a narrower and narrower slice of the electorate, and, you know, and the office park dads and these, you know, few voters in swing states. I don't know the answer, because to be honest, you know, everybody sort of wants to think that people think like us, you know, the people must deep down feel what I feel. I don't know. You know, I went to Iowa during the primaries and I saw a lot of people that I didn't have much in common with. So, you know, am I a good person to advise them how to compete for that vote? Not really. But, you know, what I did think about the convention was good was that the Democrats showed in a smiling and sunshiny way, which is what Edwards is famous for and what Obama did so well, how nasty the Republicans are by contrast. And when they talked about, you know, little things, like when Kerry said that he quoted Lincoln saying that he doesn't think God is on his side, he only prays that he's on God's side. You know, I think that they showed that there's a way to be, the way that I truly believe a majority of Americans are, pretty diverse, tolerant group of people who recognize that we're not a mono, you know, cultural country, and believe that we can all kind of get together, and that the Republicans really don't send that message, that they say that, you know, unless you are a fundamentalist Christian, you know, unless you are really hard right with the family values crowd, unless you're white, really, and unless you're benefiting from their tax cuts, which benefit such a small number of people, you're not with them. So I thought that they did a good job of highlighting that. And I also was I noticed the lapses. I noticed that Kerry highlighted his Vietnam record and not his anti-war record. You know, I noticed that they sort of steered clear of what you're saying, that those tough criticisms. But I still think that overall you felt that contrast with the Republicans, and that was their great success.
What about the Iraq War? That was a very underdeveloped theme at the convention, almost unmentioned, or horrifyingly, in Edwards' speech, he just said flat out, we're going to win the Iraq War.
Yeah.
What do you think they're in for with that, and do you think they played it right?
I thought that that was a shame. I thought it was a shame. I mean, that's been the case, though, with this set of candidates from the beginning. Edwards, who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee, had no criticism during the primaries of, you know, the line of bull that he and his colleagues were fed from this administration. And that was very notable on the campaign trail. And Kerry, of course, voted for the war and, you know, has never been a real dissenter on that issue. So there's this problem. They highlight Vietnam. And my feeling about that was, you know, finally, after all these years, Americans are kind of ready to put the Vietnam War to bed and to say, that we can hold these thoughts in our minds simultaneously, that the Vietnam War was a horrible thing and a mistake and a bad thing that our country did, and that the soldiers who fought in that war are not the villains. And I thought that the Democrats were sort of brilliant in bringing those themes together and saying, you know, you can oppose the Vietnam War and still support the troops, which has been the mantra in this country now for quite a few years.
Since the Gulf War, anyway.
Since the Gulf War.
And I think Kerry's band of brothers actually was very affecting as a viewer from the TV screen, of seeing all those guys who were in Vietnam with him, the little film strip of his Vietnam days, and then all those guys, one after another, lined up behind him, vouching for his leadership. To me, that was the one bit of theater that worked. The rest, I mean, I thought Kerry gave a decent speech, better than I thought he would. And but that kind of tugged at me a little bit
to answer the question about Iraq, then, you know, you have a situation currently that is very much like the situation Kerry was in Vietnam, where you can say people were sent in under, you know, false premises, that they're directionless, that they're victims of this violence and they don't know how to get out and there's no plan and the whole thing has been a big fiasco, and they don't go that far and they don't make the obvious parallel between Vietnam and Iraq. And that to me was, yeah, glaring failure.
And the irony, Ruth Conniff, is that Kerry's going to end up asking himself the question he asked the Senate in 1971, how do you ask a guy to be the last man to die for a mistake?
Yeah.
He's going to be asking men to die for a mistake if he's elected, which I'm still betting he's going to be elected. But he doesn't have an answer for that. I mean, he said he's going to go to the UN. He's going to work better with other nations, so maybe they'll help us out more. But he still today isn't promising to have all those troops home by the end of his first term.
Yeah.
And the only speaker I heard actually was Jesse Jackson, who said, bring the troops home. I was disappointed with Dean and Kucinich, who were carrying the banner for progressive politics all through the primaries. I heard both their speeches. Neither of them impressed me. Kucinich going, courage, America.
Yeah,
like
courage,
he's Dan
America.
Rather.
Well, but although Kucinich did touch directly on the Iraq War, I mean, he stood up there in front of people and continued to espouse that point of view. Howard Dean, on the other hand, didn't even mention it. And that was, I thought, a very glaring omission. I mean, he really was there just to endorse Kerry and to say that it was great that all these people had liked him and now they should all vote for Kerry. Goodbye. It was very short. And
made you
he
think
really
that Dean's position on the war, sorry to interrupt, was opportunistic in a way, because it just didn't seem that heartfelt. I mean, he didn't go up there. And then I saw him on Tim Russert saying, or one of those shows on Sunday saying, you know, for me, the war wasn't the most important issue. That's not why I got in the first place. I got in to talk about health care and a balanced budget, for all things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Dean has never been a great leftist, in spite of, you know, the way that the Democratic Party tried to bring him down during the primaries by associating him with the left. He really wasn't. It was Kucinich who was really the anti-war candidate, and he continued to show that in all the forums that he was part of around Boston, outside of his little few minutes of fame there on the stage. He continued to rally his supporters to talk about the problems both with Iraq and the Patriot Act, which is another glaring omission of this whole, you know, of course, Kerry voted for the Patriot Act, and we didn't hear a whole lot about that at the convention.
Why wasn't there a bounce, or wasn't there more of a bounce? Do you have a theory on that, Ruth?
Well, everybody says because the country is so evenly divided and it's going to be a close election and people are so hardened in their positions already on either side that there wasn't going to be a big shift. And that's why, you know, we're talking about the swing voters, that both candidates went to Davenport, Iowa, to court five voters. You know, this is the nature of the election. At least sort of the people that are the experts in the two parties claim that this election comes down to these few little votes in these few crucial swing states.
Do you think it does, or do you think there are other ways to win than going after the five voters in Davenport?
Well, I do, and I wonder, you know, the whole issue, you know, what Sharpton lit the room on fire with was this issue of the stolen election of 2000 and the idea that there are all of these people who died for the right to vote and the civil rights martyrs and, you know, that this vote can't be held cheap. And there are a lot of potential voters out there who could be motivated to go to the polls. And this is the effort that Jackson and Sharpton and others are making to get voters who can't necessarily be counted on to go to the polls at all to come out. And maybe they will, and maybe it won't be such a close election after all. The other thing is, undecided voters, as you get closer and closer to the election, don't really tend to vote for the incumbent because they're still undecided, and it's really the whole election is really a referendum on the incumbent. So If those votes cut Kerry's way, if some people come out to the polls who weren't expected, then maybe Kerry will win by a wide margin.
I mean, that's my theory. My theory is that Kerry's going to win. It's always been my theory ever since he rose to the top, and it's because I think a lot of people who voted for Nader are going to go for Kerry. Then some Republicans who don't like the balanced budget are going to go for Kerry. Some Republicans who are from military families are going to go for Kerry. And I can't envision many people who didn't vote for Bush last time who are going to vote for Bush this time. So I think most people who are changing toward Kerry.
And people were bored by the election in 2002. I mean, a lot of people didn't want to go and vote because they thought that Gore and Bush were equally boring. And that was why Nader caused a lot of excitement, because there was just no energy for this presidential election in 2000. And I think this is a very different year.
Did you hear Gore's speech at the convention?
I did, yeah. I thought he did a good job. I thought he was the loose, relaxed candidate that he should have been in 2000. I mean, he seemed to be comfortable with himself. And that seemed to be the big problem with Gore, aside from his politics, of course. But on the stump, he was so dead. And I thought, you know, something about getting out of politics and starting to speak his mind and be a little more honest about what he believes has really done wonders for the guy.
And he was a little self-deprecating at the start. And strategically, though, I think he made two crucial points. One was that to those of you who voted for a third party, he said, clearly going right at the Nader people, do you still believe that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans? And then he said to Republicans who might have voted, or independents who might have voted for Bush, is this really what you bargained for?
Yeah.
Especially with the deficit going just through the roof. So I think he really realizes that two of those constituencies that may drift toward Kerry, he tried to push them in that direction. I think it made a lot of sense. I wouldn't have minded seeing more of them. What about Clinton? You hear Clinton's speech?
I thought Clinton was great. He's such a master. I mean, even while he was president, as much as we criticized him on the left, I just kept feeling like we've got to appreciate that this guy is such a master politician and that we may not see this again in our lifetime. And he hit it just right, being so self-deprecating and being able to be self-deprecating on two issues where the Republicans need to be hit and Bush in particular. He linked himself with Bush as a draft dodger, which was interesting that he was willing to put himself out there in order to tar the president with the same brush. And as a member of the top 1%, you know, laughing about the fact that he makes so much money now that he's getting these massive tax cuts from this administration. And he just, you know, his style and delivery were great. And I thought that he did exactly what he needed to do, which was to minimize himself so he didn't outshine Kerry, and to make fun of himself, and with that, make fun of the president, so that he could highlight these couple of issues.
The thing about Clinton, though, that I never liked was he always seems to dissociate himself from his own flaws. So when he talked about, you know, Kerry being a heroic warrior and him being a draft dodger, it just seemed like he's doing the same old thing there.
That he himself forgives himself.
Yeah, you know, oh, look at me, I screwed up. I screwed up in Rwanda. I screwed up. I didn't fight in Vietnam, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, he's clearly the most appealing character that he himself has ever met.
Yeah, he loves talking about himself, whether it's
but he's
doing
good.
Something wrong or bad.
You got to hand it to him. I mean, he did a good job. Yeah, I mean, he's just, he was very gracious, I thought.
Where does the election go from here, do you think? Got the Republican convention coming up. Any surprises there? For a while there, people were betting that Cheney would get knocked off the ticket. Is that a possibility?
No, I don't think so. I think that what happens is that people like us talk about Cheney getting knocked off the ticket because we see Halliburton and we see just what an unappealing character he is. And, you know, he's stumping the country now, going to these invitation-only events where people are frisked at the door, you know, making sure that only people who like Cheney are there. And we just think, God, this guy has a constituency of three, and how could they possibly keep him? But the reason they keep him is because he is their guy for the base, and he is the hard right, you know, uncompromising on abortion. Really, he's the guy that symbolizes the Bush administration's link with its base and sends the message to the base that, you know, we haven't forgotten you. We're not really this party of moderation. We're not really the party of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rudy Giuliani. We're the party of the Christian right and the people who really care about especially the abortion issue. And, you know, gay rights is a little bit more of a problem since he has that lesbian daughter and since his wife came out recently and said that she thought it's a state issue. But he has been traditionally just associated with conservative values. And I think that that's his value to the administration. And it's sort of obscured to the mainstream because it's not, you know, that's not what we are reading about and thinking about all the time. But I think for the base, for the Jim Dobson listeners out there, that's definitely, that's really important.
So Karl Rove sends him out just to get that crowd going, make sure they come out. Rove has been saying that there are 3 million of those evangelical Christians didn't show up at the polls in 2000. They need to show up now. Maybe those are the people they think is going to go vote for Bush that's going to tip the balance. How big is that right-wing evangelical base? That's what I'm worried about. I'm seeing Bush's numbers. You know, after he's had a disastrous 3.5 years, this Iraq war blown up in his face, and his numbers just, they don't get below 41%, 45%. What's your theory on that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that a lot of people aren't paying attention. I think that that it's confusing. I think that there's not a clear alternative on the Iraq war. You know, I mean, I think that's a problem that the Democrats haven't staked out the opposite position so clearly that, it's not enough to say, well, what, as Gore did, whatever you thought of the Iraq war when we were getting into it, isn't it clear that it hasn't been managed properly? I mean, sort of the details of management don't really amount to a ringing critique, although I do think a lot of Americans think that it's been a disaster, don't trust Bush, think that they're, you know, clearly this administration has not been forthright. You know, I think that people are scared. And that they like the idea of a strong leader, and that Bush seems decisive, even if he's wrong in what he does, even if he's dishonest in what he does, that he doesn't seem to be plagued by any doubt. And that when you're having a terrorist alert, you know, every few minutes, and you see the armed cops on the subway when you're commuting to work, and you're really worried, that it comes down to that. And I think people sort of jettison everything else, and they just think, am I safe?
What do you make the latest terrorist alert?
You know, I thought the timing was suspicious. I mean, you have to take seriously that we are a nation under threat, and that's the thing about going to these conventions and seeing all this crazy security. On the one hand, you think, is this necessary? Is this America? And on the other hand, you think a bomb could go off, a plane could fly into a building. So, you know, it leaves you in an ambivalent place. And I think the administration has completely compromised its credibility by lying about Iraq and being so wrong about all of the justifications that it offered for the war. And so you're left wondering. And then Tom Ridge comes out and says, the Department of Homeland Security is not political, and this terrorist alert shows that George Bush is doing an excellent job on terrorism. So, you know, clearly it is political. And at the same time, clearly there is some threat. Is it a threat on Monday? Is it a threat, you know, this week? Or is this four-year-old information just part of a, you know, a larger body of information that we can consider over more time? It's really hard to dissect that. I can't dissect that any better than any other newspaper reader. So you're just left with a vague feeling of distrust and insecurity.
I've been reading the 9/11 Commission report, Ruth Conniff, and to me, you know, as a journalist who's not privy, neither are you for that matter, of the information coming out of the CIA and all these reports that the president gets, you know, I'm thinking back to those attacks on the embassy bombings in Africa. God, at that point, we thought it was just wag the dog, you know, but then they were having these, you know, alerts come over their desk that, you know, Al-Qaeda's done this, it's done that, it's warned that there's going to be another Hiroshima. And so maybe they have stuff that we don't know about. But as you say, they've been monkeying around so much, it's just hard to know.
Well, and plus the whole terror alert system is so useless. I mean, they say, you should be worried. And then they say, go about your life as normal. You know, there's nothing really to be done. And the whole purpose of these different color-coded alerts seems just to be able to say later, well, we told you there was going to be a problem. You know, they often say that there's not much that they can do, that it's inevitable that it's going to happen. And then even as they ratchet up the anxiety and the color of the alert, they continue to insist that people go about their lives as normal and that there's nothing really to be done. So it just doesn't feel like there's any purpose to the whole thing except to keep people insecure.
And that works for them. That's one of the only cards they have to play, is the fear card. What are the chances, one way or another, hook or by crook, that the Bush administration is going to try to steal this election?
You know, I am very concerned about the voting machines, particularly since reading the latest cover story in The Nation about the voting machines and how there is not only no paper trail but no access to the electronic information to audit the vote after it's been cast. And this is a third of all voters are going to be using these machines. And, of course, you know, it makes you feel less secure knowing that they're big Republican contributors who run the Diebold Corporation, who make the machines, many of them. So it seems to me that in this last period before the election, people who are worried about that the stealing of the vote, or, you know, feel that the 2000 election was stolen, should be focusing on the nuts and bolts technology issue, because there's got to be a paper trail and it is possible to make one. And so it seems crazy to me that they're refusing to create that paper audit. And also that, you know, when a voter casts a vote on one of these electronic machines, what happens inside the machine, which no one can see, no lawyer, no election monitor who's posted there has any idea whether when you push the carry button, carry gets registered. There's a code that corresponds to the candidate. And that information is privy only to the people who own the machines, the company. And they're refusing to release that to the parties. And they're confusing the issue of a secret ballot and a secret vote count by saying, because of the secret ballot, we can't let anybody know what this code is, and therefore there can't be really an audit. And what they call a recount is just a printout of the same information that you get electronically. So there's no real accounting. There's no going through, sifting through, seeing what happened. And that just shouldn't be. I mean, that's got to be fixed before the election.
I know there's some groups working on this, NAACP Legal Defense Fund for one. I think the ACLU's got a voting rights project that's working on it. There's a representative Democrat in Florida, I think, who's joined a suit to make sure that they're paper ballots. But at this point, that's up in the air. And then there's also question about this, you know, felon disenfranchisement. Jeb Bush was trying to do that again. I guess they got a court order against that, or he was overruled on that when it showed up that he was just aiming at African Americans, that they made an effort, absolute effort, to make sure there weren't any Hispanics on this list of voters that they were going to disqualify. And they were going to disqualify, I think, 2,000 legitimate voters out of 48,000. So that's not a great percentage. What about the idea that Bush is either has Bin Laden right now under wraps, or is going to drag him out of the cave by his beard?
You know, I mean, again, you sort of feel like you're wandering into conspiracy theory zone with these ideas, but it seems to me that this administration has raised so many questions about, I mean, who would have thought, you know, when Colin Powell made his presentation to the UN and he said, look, here's the hard evidence, and they just completely blew off the idea that there weren't weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They had all this evidence. Everybody knew it. And there was this sort of sarcasm that developed, you know, not just from the Republican officials, but from the Democrats and from the news media saying, you know, people who suspect that there's nothing there. It's just ridiculous. I mean, there's so many arguments and there's so much evidence. And so now we've been through the invasion. We've been through the, you know, we're in the occupation, and there's not a single weapon of mass destruction that's turned up. So you look back and you think, you know, at that time, we all were sort of cowed and just saying, oh, you know, we don't want to be conspiracy theorists. And, you know, it turns out that none of the premises that they suggested for the war were correct. So now we're in the same situation with the election. We think, you know, we remember what happened in 2000. It seemed so outrageous. And yet there was a great move, you know, from the Democrats as well as the Republicans. Let's put this behind us. It's ridiculous. You know, we don't want to be sour grapes. We don't want to keep harping on this. It's still a democracy. It wasn't a stolen election. He's still a legitimate president. We got to move forward. And it seems to me that a lot of the problems haven't been fixed, and that there are a lot of things that are possible. Tom DeLay's staffers could go down and stage another false, you know, protest. And they have all kinds of ways of trying to suppress certain votes and make the election tilt their way. And I just think that the Democrats, if they want to seriously contest for power here, need to be prepared for that. And it doesn't seem to me that they necessarily are.
Last question, Ruth Conniff, who's going to win?
I still think that Kerry can win, but I think it's going to be close, and I really don't know.
That's going to have to be it for now. I got my money on Kerry. That's not an endorsement. It's just a bet. Ruth Conniff, thanks for joining me on the show.
Sure, man.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.